What I'm talking about now is fairly important because we've heard a lot about science, but really not too much about what makes science work in the first place. You heard a bit in the last session a bit about that, actually, about how science grew up in the Christian worldview. So I'm going to talk a bit more about that. And just to remind you, we have a website, creation.com, and we have a sign-up sheet for our free email newsletter as well at the back. So look on our table, which is... It should be easy to find it in one of the corners there. So sign up for a free email newsletter. We promise not to spam you or give or sell your address to any third party. So that's one thing we recommend because it will keep you up to date with creation speakers in your area, as well as some new things coming up on our website and some of the articles in our archives of about 9,000 articles covering all sorts of topics to do with creation, the Bible, and Christianity. Now this talk, for instance, has a few articles on our site devoted to it. One is called The Christian Roots of Science, Biblical Roots of Modern Science. creation.com/roots is a shortcut we have for some of our articles, so it makes it easy to remember and find. And that picture there is Sir Isaac Newton, who is regarded as the greatest scientist of all time. Who discovered the law of gravity, three laws of motion, the spectrum of light, which is my own field of spectroscopy, this goes to Newton, the law of cooling, invented the reflecting telescope, jointly invented calculus, and yet he wrote more about the Bible than he wrote about science. He wrote huge amounts of work defending biblical chronology, which is actually means a young earth chronology, than he wrote about science. So this idea of some sort of conflict between science and Christianity is a complete fiction when you look at the history as well as the logic. Now another article is of mine is called Why Does Science Work at All? And creation.com/why science covers those sorts of issues as well, the assumptions needed for science to work. And in fact, the last chapter of my book, Greatest Hoax on Earth, covers some of the material in what I'm talking about as well. And if things run out here, you can order from our website, creation.com, and just tell them that I said you could have postage free. Because if we run out, we regard it as our fault, so we're not going to punish you for running out of things. So you go to our website, our web store, and just when you make an order, just ask for postage to be free because you were at this creation conference. Now, another book you might like is also on our table, Christianity for Skeptics. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we have in our materials is all about why creation is true and why we should believe the Bible at face value. But this book goes into things like why should we trust the Bible in the first place? How do we know that Jesus rose from the dead? And how do we answer Muslims and Hindus and atheists, New Agers? What's wrong with atheism? A whole chapter on that. How do you reconcile a loving God with death and suffering in the world? These are things which is one of the books we have, which is quite different from the other books of ours, and that's on our book table too. Now, just to remind you first about the difference between the operational science, which is what I'm going to talk about now, what is actually needed for operational science to work, the sort that put men on the moon and cures diseases, builds technology, in contrast to the evolution, which, as I say, was more a question of history than a question of science. So let's look at what operational science needs to work. Well, one of the assumptions we need is that the universe is real. Well, that seems obvious to us. And it comes from the fact that God created the heavens and the earth. So matter is real. It has an objective reality, regardless of what we might think about it. I don't really care if you believe in the law of gravity or not. You'll still fall off a cliff. So there's an objective reality independent of how we think. So this is very compatible with the biblical teaching that matter is real because God made it. So it seems rational to us, but there are some belief systems like the Eastern religions who almost deny the reality of the universe. They will claim that everything is an illusion. Now, one thing to think about that is if that is a self-refuting statement. A lot of attacks on Christianity are self-refuting because if everything is an illusion, that statement just made is also an illusion too. I'll go through some of the self-refuting statements often made by anti-Christians, like someone who says, there is no truth. Okay, how do you know? Is that true? Okay, another one. You can't know anything for certain. Well, how do you know that for certain? And one very common among atheistic scientists who really ought to know better if they actually thought a bit logically about it is that we should accept only scientifically testable claims. You've probably heard that from people like Richard Dawkins and co. The point is, that's a claim. Can that claim be tested scientifically? You can't put that claim in a laboratory and test it. So therefore, it's self-refuting because it's not a scientifically testable claim. Therefore, we should not accept that claim by its own reasoning. Another one which Christians, very common you hear now when we try and defend the pro-life position or pro-marriage, that Christians are wrong to judge that some behaviors are wrong, but isn't that a judgment itself? And one I've actually had from a cultist who denied the deity of Christ and the Trinity, and he claimed that I shouldn't be using the word Trinity, I should stick to words that are found in the Bible only. But the problem is, the word Bible is not found in the Bible. Now, another very important thing for science to work is that the universe is orderly. Now, again, the universe might superficially seem chaotic, but in fact, the Bible tells us that God is the author of confusion. He is a divine lawmaker. And there, from the biblical perspective, we should expect some underlying order in the universe. And this is essential for science to work. Science can't work unless water is always going to boil at 100 degrees, no matter if it's on Mars under the same conditions, same pressure and concentration, it'll boil at the same temperature. You see, but the thing is, why should that be? Again, it's this problem of induction that you heard last time. There's no reason from an atheistic point of view to expect the universe to be orderly, and you wouldn't expect it to be orderly if Zeus and his gang were in charge, because every god in the Greek pantheon has his own set of rules. And if the New Ages are right, the universe is one big thought, it could change its mind at any moment. And you heard about how a multiverse idea cannot give you the idea of natural laws either, because we could be in one of these strange universes where a certain law applies, but some of the other universes may not have that law. So again, multiverses can't get you real science either. They claim to be a scientific viewpoint, but it actually is a very anti-scientific viewpoint, as you learned. But only the Judeo-Christian worldview of a divine lawmaker gives you the whole idea of rules and laws that scientists can investigate. No other belief system can do that. And we also have that man may investigate the universe. You see, God gave man dominion over creation. That's right back in Genesis 1. You see, we don't have to pray to the river god before we boil water. Creation is not divine. In fact, if creation was divine, like some of the environmentalists seem to think, we could not do science. We cannot investigate the divine. Only if we're given dominion over creation do we have the right to investigate it, and in fact the obligation to. And that's why people like Newton and Kepler thought they were doing God's work with their scientific endeavors. I mean, Kepler was very famous for saying that he was thinking God's thoughts, God's thoughts after him. It's all a penny chicken, I think. And even before him, even after him, you've got people like Sir Michael Faraday, basically a little bit before Charles Darwin. He was the discoverer of the laws of electromagnetism, which means electrical generators. He discovered the electrical generator, which is what's powering our electrical stuff, ultimately. And he was a member of what people now call fundamentalist sect, because a sect which is very strict about the Bible. And deeply religious, viewed science, exploration of nature, as an extension of his heartfelt faith. And again, we see sometimes we debate a conflict of science and religion, but Faraday saw no such division. The book of nature we have to read is written by the finger of God. So unraveling the mysteries of nature was to discover the manifestations of God, because the science that he was doing was trying to discover exactly how God was upholding his creation, the laws by which he upholds creation. This is what Michael Faraday was trying to do. But this tradition goes back a long way, in fact, even into the Middle Ages, which were basically a Christian worldview in the Middle Ages. In other words, what C.S. Lewis would call mere Christianity, a general belief in the authority of the Bible, that there's a creator, that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. That sort of mere Christianity was the dominant belief system in the Middle Ages. And this was actually the period where modern science really started to flourish, where it was still born in places like Greece and China, which did not have this worldview of God as a divine lawmaker. So here's Rodney Stark, who wrote a book about this whole thing, it's called For the Glory of God, and he said it was not the wisdom of the East that gave rise to science. Science was not the work of Western secularists or even deists. It was entirely the work of devout believers in an active, conscious creator God. Now, if you listen to the propaganda in the education system, somehow Christianity is anti-science. But in fact, as was shown here, it was Christianity that brought science into existence in the first place. Now, another book written about this is by James Hannam, who had earned his PhD in the history of science from Cambridge University in the UK. And he wrote a book called God's Philosophers, which is all about the Middle Ages' contribution to science. And he says that recent research has shown that the Middle Ages were a period of enormous advances in science, technology, and culture. Now, the propaganda is that the Middle Ages were the Dark Ages, but that was actually a propaganda invented in the Renaissance. Because they talk about the Renaissance as being the rebirth, but the Renaissance was actually a reactionary step to go back, ignore the medieval advances, and go back to this romanticized view of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and popularizing their works, but ignoring the huge advances that had been made in the Middle Ages in all sorts of different areas. And Hannam's book talks about a lot of these. You see, the compass, paper, printing, stirrups, and gunpowder all appeared in Western Europe between 500 and 1500 AD. We see even more things. Printing. And the stirrup, you see, stirrup meant you could ride a horse properly, which is a very important thing. Instead of having to ride a chariot or very unstable riding a horse, you have a stirrup, which is really much more stable than anything that had gone on before them. And this is why Europeans could conquer the world. You see, China was once ahead of Europe in science, but Europe very much quickly overtook it. And you think of, people might decry the colonialism, but why was Europe in a position to be colonialist? It's because they made these huge advances in science, thanks to their Christian worldview. It doesn't mean they always used the science for good purposes, but the point is the science came about because of their Christian worldview. And more medieval Europe invented the spectacles. I mean, basically, a lot of you guys are wearing a Dark Ages invention. Spectacles were invented in the monasteries in the 13th century. So the monasteries of all places, but they discovered the laws of optics and spectacles in the 13th century. And things like mechanical clock, so timekeeping began there, real proper timekeeping, much better than hourglasses were before. And also developments in wind power and water power. It was basically an industrial revolution going on in the Middle Ages because wind and water power was a big advance on what had gone on before. And the blast furnace enabled steel to be made. And they also developed the heavy plow, which meant that the fields, agriculture, could become much more productive than it was previously. So there was actually a big population explosion in the Middle Ages compared to the Roman Empire times, because the ground could now support far more people, being so much more productive than it was. And here's more, lenses and cameras. All these things that we take for granted today actually owe their beginnings to these great scientists in the Middle Ages. And you also have people in the Middle Ages like Buridan and Orame in medieval France who even proposed that the Earth could be going around the sun. I mean, they still believed the Earth was the center, but they said there was nothing in science or scripture that could disprove the other way around, that the Earth was the one rotating. In fact, they even said it was more economical to have a small Earth rotate than the huge cosmos rotate. So they thought on economical grounds, it made more sense for the Earth to be rotating, and the Bible did not disprove that. So in fact, 200 years before Galileo, the medieval scientists had actually disproved most of the arguments used against him. And also go to Europe, you see these great cathedrals. These are architectural works of genius. Notre Dame in Paris, it took almost 200 years to build it. That's how amazing it was. I mean, Noah only took 70 years to build the ark, okay? But this is more like 200 years. And you see the outside and the inside were magnificent structures. And the thing is, this is a revolutionary advance because you see how the huge, wide open spaces in the cathedrals because they had these advances in architecture, like the flying buttresses that you could see on the right side of this picture, which could actually spread the load, which enabled much higher walls to be built because the stress was being taken by these flying buttresses. So again, huge advances in all sorts of different areas. Were done in the Middle Ages. So they weren't really dark ages at all. Now, but there was a big advance even on top of that when the Reformation happened. You see, the Reformation was the rediscovery of the authority and sufficiency of Scripture. But another thing the Reformation did was go back to the plain meaning of the Bible, because some of the medieval theologians got a bit carried away with allegorical interpretations, which really weren't grounded in the biblical text. And the Reformation rediscovered the objective nature of the biblical text. And we have a man, Peter Harrison, who even wrote a book called The Bible, Protestantism and the Rise of Modern Science. And he said, had it not been for the rise of a literal interpretation of the Bible by early modern scientists, modern science may not have arisen at all. See, once again, you will hear in the newspapers and the education system that a literal view of the Bible will harm science and take us back to the Dark Ages. That's the propaganda. But in fact, thanks to a literal interpretation, that science made a great leap forward even over the top of the Middle Ages advances, which was saying a lot. And he said, in sum, the Bible and its literal interpretation have played a vital role in the development of modern science. See, what an admission which is very different from what you normally hear. And in fact, you have other historians of science who say the same thing, like Stephen Snowbelin in Canada, who said that recent work has demonstrated a direct and positive relationship between the resurgence of a literal exegesis of the Bible in the Protestant Reformation and the rise of empirical method in modern science. And then he clarifies what he's talking about here, not wooden literalism, which means ignoring the figures of speech in the Bible. Like when Jesus said, "I am the door," you don't go and look for a knob on him, okay? That's wooden literalism, but in fact, literal really is the plain meaning. See, when the church fathers and the medieval people used the word literal, they meant what the text actually would mean to its original readers, which is what I would now call the grammatical historical approach to the Bible. So what do the text mean to the original readers? You see, to them, you see, when Jesus says, "I'm a door," the figurative meaning, in fact, is a literal meaning because that's what the text is teaching. It does not mean literalistic, which is ignoring any possibility of figure of speech. And that's what he's talking about here. Now, the point of that, going back to the objective meaning of the text, was transferred to objective understanding of nature. Because in the Renaissance, you have this problem. They go back to Aristotle, really promotes the works of Aristotle. He had his own ideas of how nature should behave. You see, he claimed that a heavy object will fall faster than a light object. But the medieval scientists and the Reformation scientists realized, well, God is free to create how he pleased. He is sovereign. He doesn't need to follow Aristotelian philosophy. And therefore, if the Bible is silent on something, the only way you can find out how God is upholding nature is to investigate, do experiments on it. So in fact, they dropped a heavy object and light object together. And apart from air resistance, we know they fall at the same rate. And on the moon, with the vacuum, a lead weight and a feather do fall exactly at the same rate. But here's a case. What they were doing here, according to Snowbelin, was that they applied this objective understanding of the Bible to objective understanding of nature. So they worked out what the Bible objectively means, and then they worked out what nature was objectively doing. So this is a big advance and led to the modern experimental science. So this is a great leap forward, and it was building on the shoulders of giants anyway, because the medievals had done so much, but the Reformation really took it to another level. Now, let's look at another perspective of what's needed for science. And one thing is that our thoughts are rational. You see, we actually can think rationally and logically. And that comes because God made us in his image. God thinks rationally. and logically, therefore, we should as well. Jesus Christ is called the Logos, the word from which we get logic. So logical thinking is essential for Christians. But if evolution is true, there's no reason to believe that our brains are logical, because we're just rearranged, it's just an evolved monkey brain, or ape brain, or whatever you want to call it. There's no reason to expect it to think logically. See, natural selection can select only for survival value, not for truth or for logic. So evolution cannot explain rational thought. And C.S. Lewis put this pretty well. He said, if the whole evolution of man was an accident, then all our present thoughts are mere accidents, the accidental byproducts of the movement of atoms. And this holds for the thoughts of the materialists as well as for anyone else's. But then if their thoughts of materialism are merely accidental byproducts, why should we believe them to be true? I see no reason to believe that one accident should be able to give me a correct account of all the other accidents. So even though the atheists might call themselves rationalists, they cannot justify rationality under their own worldview. And some of them call themselves free thinkers, but if they're right, the thoughts of their brain are just the result of movements of atoms obeying the fixed laws of chemistry. So in reality, they can't help what they believe because it's just the result of chemistry. So atheism cannot provide the basis for rational, logical thought. Now, one last thing I want to mention is that we need honesty in reporting of results, because I can't possibly do all the experiments I'm building on the shoulders of other people. I mean, I'm not going to go and measure the charge or weight or mass of an electron myself, because it's been done for me, and that I can use those results. But I have to assume from that the results have been reported honestly. Now, once again, the Bible tells us why we should be honest, because God forbids false witness, and Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. He said, but truth shall set you free. So the Bible gives you a very good reason to want to tell the truth. But if evolution is true, why should we tell the truth? If we can propagate our genes better by telling a lie, then why not do that? And you see, even the atheists have realized that. Here is Jarol Nanya, who's an evolutionist. He said there are a lot of people uncomfortable with accepting evolution because it leads to what they see as a moral vacuum in which their best impulses have no basis in nature. And here is Richard Dawkins, the world champion evolutionist and Darwinist, saying that's just tough. We have to face up to the truth. So he's admitting here, if evolution were true, there's no objective basis for right and wrong, and therefore no reason to be honest. So evolution cannot give you a basis for honesty and truth-telling. And is it any wonder then we see things like this, where we have articles like Epidemic of Fraud in Science? I think you remember this fellow, don't you? That was published in our Journal of Creation. And this is based, very thoroughly documented, in secular journals like the magazine Discover, which said that fraud is now a serious, deeply rooted problem. And in fact, the prestigious journal Nature, probably the most prestigious in the world, talked about this fraud in these top universities like Cornell and Harvard and Yale. Now, Harvard and Yale were founded to be Christian universities. I mean, you look at the banners there. You've got Veritas, which looks at Veritas, which is light and truth. That's this biblical term. Jesus was meant to be the light and the truth. And therefore, this Harvard and Yale were founded to glorify Christ. And yeah, you've got the Ummim and the Thurim. That's what that symbol there, the Hebrew stuff. This is, again, a biblical reference. But now these places are founts of anti-Christian bigotry. Most of the universities in this country and in mine are very anti-Christian in their outlook. So they've actually departed from the intentions of their founder. So you might say that the fraud is just reaping their fruits of their rejection of Christianity, which provides the basis for truth. They reject the fruits, they reject the roots. Of course, the fruits are going to have a problem. But now, where did sin and lying come from? Well, according to the Bible, that started with Adam and the fall. And as Peter Harrison's written in another more recent book called The Fall of Man and the Foundations of Science, where he discusses another great leap forward still after what I've just been talking about. Another great leap forward happened because of literal belief in a fall of Adam. This goes into Francis Bacon in the 17th century, where he said that his project to reform philosophy was motivated by an attempt to determine whether the human mind might be by any means be restored to its perfect and original condition, or if that may not be, yet reduced to a better condition than that which it now is. Because they believed that the fall of man didn't just affect our morality, but also affected our intellect. So they clearly believe that Adam, before the fall, had some amazing encyclopedic knowledge. And their whole project for science was to try to recapture some of that knowledge they believed Adam had. But you see how this presupposes that the Bible is accurate when it talks about a real man called Adam and a real fall from grace. So this is yet another very important milestone for the development of modern science. And yet again, of course, people don't want us to believe in a literal Adam, and yet Peter Harrison is saying that this is a very important milestone for science to advance, was this very belief in a literal Adam and a literal fall. Now, what can we do about this? I mean, science is an amazing potential, but I think it's also been marred. And see, science by itself is morally neutral. You see, science can tell you that pushing someone off a cliff is going to kill you, it kills that person, but it won't tell you whether it's right or wrong to do it. Okay, science can't do much, which is why you have science so grossly misused in the Nazi regime, just inventing more and more ways of killing millions of people. That was still science, but it was a very wicked abuse of science. So if you want to recover science for good and eliminate the problems, we need to recover the roots. And this is what the late Margaret Thatcher said. If we try to take the fruits of Christianity without its roots, the fruits will wither. And they will not come again until you nurture the roots. This is what we need to do. We need to nurture the roots again, which have been largely lost. And sadly, there are a number of of so-called Christian organizations like BioLogos, which want to try to disconnect Christianity from real history. They basically accept the history of the atheists, of uniformitarian long-age geology and goo-to-you evolution, but it totally disconnects the Bible from the real world. It's totally useless. Yet the Bible is a history book. It gives the true history of the world. And she also gives this warning here that we must not profess the Christian faith and go to church because we want social reforms or a better standard of behavior, but because we accept the sanctity of life, the responsibility that comes with freedom and the supreme sacrifice of Christ. So hopefully I've given you enough examples of how the Christian worldview was essential for science. First of all, in the Middle Ages, with a mere Christian worldview leading to enormous advances in all sorts of areas, but in the Reformation, with its rediscovery of objective understanding of Scripture being transferred to objective understanding of nature, and then the fall of Adam and the people like Francis Bacon trying to recapture some of the knowledge they believe Adam had before the fall.